Community Radio.
It's about real people.
Not sound bites.
Not more talking heads.
Not on this show.
Interchange is a community access media forum fostering unfiltered open dialogue on the people, issues, and events impacting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Conversations that challenge the ways we perceive the world around us.
Real people.
Real issues.
This is your forum.
This is Interchange.
Hello, good evening. Thank you for joining us here on Interchange. I'm your host, Ryan Dawes. We have two interviews lined up for you tonight. Later in the hour, we'll be joined by Indiana State Treasurer and candidate for U.S. Senate, Republican Richard Murdoch. We'll talk with him about his campaign against Senator Richard Lugar in the May primary. But first, we kick off our election coverage with the Monroe County Clerk, Linda Robbins, who joins us now on the phone. Robbins, among other things, oversees the voting process here in Monroe County. Linda Robbins, thank you very much for joining us here on Interchange.
Thank you so much for having me on. I'm excited about this election and being here.
Now, we have a lot of different options for county voters coming up in the May primary as well as in the November general election. We have things like satellite and early voting. We have absentee voting that's available to voters, vote by mail, and of course, election day voting that we're all mostly familiar with. Let's start off by talking a little bit about the options that are available to county voters. First off, I think the nearest opportunity that we have as citizens to cast our vote in Monroe County is satellite voting and early voting. Could you explain a little bit about satellite voting, where we could find these locations, and what sort of role this serves the community if we don't want to vote on Election Day in May?
Absolutely. Well, as you know, Indiana allows for voters to start casting their ballots 30 days before the election. So April 9th, the polls are officially open for anybody who wants to vote by absentee. Or we call it absentee, even though they can be in person at a satellite location. We have, as in the past, the Curry Building is available, and that's at 7th and Wharton. And those hours are from 8 a.m. to 6 o'clock p.m. But because some people have a difficulty getting downtown and we expect that we might have an overflow of voters this year, we've also established satellite voting, which is away from the clerk's office, at five separate locations. And it's only 2 days each. It's at each of those locations, but it gives people from all over Monroe County an ability to go closer to home and have an opportunity to vote without the long lines.
Do you have those locations handy?
I do. We have Evangelical Community Church, which is on 503 South High Street, and the voting dates for that location is April 16th and 17th. We also have the National Guard Armory, and that's at 3308 South State Road 37, and voting dates at that location is April 19th through 20th. We have Assembly Hall, and this is the south side door, and that's 1001 East 17th Street, and dates there are April 23rd and 24th. St. John's Catholic Church is another location. That is 4607 West State Road 46. This is an Ellettsville location for our very west side voters, and those dates are April 26th through 27, and St. Paul's United Methodist Church at 4201 West 3rd Street is available on April 3rd through May 1st. And anybody can vote at any of these sites for any reason. There's no restrictions other than you have to be a registered voter to in this county and have proper ID in order to vote.
And that's something you can just show up. You don't have to make an appointment. You just show up with your voter ID, and you can cast your vote.
That's correct. And that voter ID is essentially, let's talk about that for just a second, because that's any federal or state of Indiana issued picture ID that has an expiration date on it.
Now, while we're on the subject, how can we get a voter ID? Is it through the Bureau of Motor Vehicles?
You can through the Bureau of Bureau of Motor Vehicles. And even if you do not drive, you can still get an ID through them. If you are a student at IU or at Ivy Tech or any other state-sponsored schools, if you bring in your student ID, you would be able to vote using that. Now, if you first time registered to vote and you were previously out of state and you have a student ID, you may have to come with some utility bill or bank statement or something that proves that you are truly a resident at that location. But we have, as they register to vote, they will be notified if they have to bring something.
Now, let's talk about precincts, how we figure out our precinct and how we go about register for voting, because as is the case with many students, we move around a lot, and maybe it might be something that where we have to, you know, re-register to vote. Is that even the case if we've moved around within Bloomington but are still a resident? How do we go about registering to vote if we've changed addresses or are voting in Monroe County for the first time?
There are two possibilities, and I would recommend, frankly, that anybody, and I don't care if you're a student or not, if you have moved within the last year, please update your registration or reapply. And it's not reapplying, but it is giving us a change of address, so you will avoid any problems at the polls. But you can do this either by coming into our voter registration office that is in the Curry Building at 7th and Morton Street, and they can help you there with most anything, or you can go online at Indiana, www.in.gov/SOS/elections, and there is a portal for voters where they can get forms to register to vote and to register for an absentee ballot.
And what is the deadline for registering to vote?
It has to be, the deadline is before early voting starts, so that is on April 8th.
And that is to register, even if you want to vote on election day, that deadline is still the same?
That's correct.
I see. Now, some of the other options we have, vote by mail. Can you explain vote by mail? I remember I was in Oregon during the 2008 election, and I voted as an Indiana resident while in Oregon through the vote by mail system, and I thought that was really handy because I was in transit throughout Oregon at the time. Could you explain a little bit about vote by mail, and does that interact at all with absentee voting?
It does. Of course, the date for people to apply for an application for absentee ballot by mail has already started. As a matter of fact, we've sent out over 200 so far this last week. And this is to enable people who are over the age of 65, people who are caretakers or people who are ill and can't have to stay home, who would like to vote by mail, people who feel that the polling place may not be accessible to them, and so they are eligible to vote by mail. Someone who is a service worker, like a fireman or a police officer, anybody who may be may have to work on election day is eligible to vote by mail. And there are a few other reasons that on a case-by-case basis. But there's also, for people who are bedridden, and or people who are caring for people who are bedridden. And this could be somebody that was in the hospital, you know, last minute and didn't realize that they would be unable to go to the polls. We can send someone to them by travel board. And this is if they call our office and ask, we can get for them a Republican and Democrat that actually go to the hospital or to their home and will vote for them, or not vote for them, but deliver the ballot, and you vote, and then they will take the ballot back to the office here. So that's an amazing thing we can do also to help people vote.
Now, why just offer the vote by mail to maybe those who are working that day or to those who might be bedridden? Why not offer it to everyone? Is it a particular strain on your resources at the clerk's office?
It is just against state law. We're just going by state law at this point. And as of now, our Indiana legislators don't feel that it would be a benefit for everybody to vote by mail.
What do you think about that? Do you think it would be easier and more, would elections be more accessible if vote by mail were available to everybody?
I do. Yes, I do. And of course, I'm a big proponent of enabling people to vote no matter what. And I think that this would greatly increase the amount of voter participation if it was as easy as just filling out a ballot and putting it back in the mail. And I think Oregon has probably one of the highest voter turnout ratios because of that. Because they can by mail, and I find that pretty exciting, and I would hope someday Indiana would move that direction, but I'm not sure.
And what is easier for the clerk's office as far as time and resources? Either voting in person or at the satellite locations on election day or early voting compared to vote by mail. I'm just wondering about the resources. Clerk's office.
If we only had vote by mail, it would be much better as far as resources. But as it is now, we have lots of employment opportunity for individuals who want to work early voting and people who want to work at the polls on election day. So I guess we're going to look at the positive side of that, Ryan.
I hear you. Now,
yes.
Let's talk a little bit about the precincts as well as the polling locations and how those numbers have changed since last time Monroe County citizens have voted. As I understand, the number of precincts has increased, but the number of polling locations has decreased. Talk about why you decided to increase the precincts first and what that process entailed.
That was quite a long process. That process took over 8 months, and it was something that we were required to do as a result of the U.S. Census and our population blocks in Monroe County. And we had, from the last census, an increase that put us over the mark as far as what we were able to do in our district. So we went from 63 precincts to 82 precincts, which is quite a few. And as a result of that, I think most voters are going to see a change in where they vote or who they're voting for, because they may have had a precinct change. And I do want to remind everybody that we are sending every registered voter a card in the beginning of April that will let them know what precinct they're voting in and where they are supposed to go vote. So I hope they keep it, and if they bring it to the poll sites, if they vote on election day, it'll make things much smoother for them as well. But we've had some concerns about, a lot of concerns, and one is most people may know is that we have tried very hard to make all of our polling sites handicap compliant, or what they call the Help America Vote Act. And it's our desire to be sure to make voting accessible for everyone as much as best we can. But coming up with 82 sites in Monroe County is next to impossible to accommodate everybody. Even 47 was difficult to be able to pinpoint, but we've done the best we can with it. And so we have co-located several of our polls just for that reason, but we've made sure we have plenty of room and we've got plenty of staff for that, and I think the voters will be very happy with the voting this year.
I think it's interesting to, or important to, remind listeners that these are facilities that were not built for specifically for elections. Maybe you might pick them based upon how well they can accommodate voters, but they're private and or public organizations that may be a church, it may be a business, it may be a facility on the university before ADA laws went into effect. So it seems, yeah, it would be very difficult to find 82 have a compliant locations. But then you did say that you were able to co-locate some of these polling locations. Talk a little bit about that process and how you went about co-locating the polling locations so that the polling locations actually dropped, but you located maybe a precinct, you merged a precinct with very low voter turnout with a precinct with, you know, medium or high turnout, so that you weren't using resources on such a small turnout or a precinct with such a historically low turnout. So talk about that decision-making process.
Well, we have done that, but on the other hand, we have done that, and we have considered where our voters are. So if we're in a very small rural area where we have low turnout, we have maintained a voting area there because we didn't want to disenfranchise anybody from being able to vote or discourage anybody from voting. So we've tried to keep them as close to home as possible. The other thing we look at is whether or not the precincts are close together. So we don't have someone on the east side of Bloomington voting on the west side of Bloomington. We try and keep them very close together so that it would be neighbors essentially voting in the same location. It's just been a, and of course I'd like to go back a little bit if we can to the HAVA. Is that you're right, the 82 locations is next to impossible. But we have done our best to make, on the 2 days a year that we have elections, most of these places have a compliant, that we have built, we have purchased ramps, we have purchased curb cuts and other items for people who are on walkers or people who have on wheelchairs or have difficulty moving around. But we've also got machines that will allow people who are visually impaired or people who have difficulty with their hands to, you know, writing with, like if they have arthritis or some kind of palsy where their hands shake, to minimize the problems that they might face in voting. And we're trying to make it possible for everybody to have the ability to vote there. What we have ended up with is this, for the primary at the schools, we have parking issues close to the entrances of the school during the times that the buses bring kids to school and the times that buses pick them up and leave. So if someone is their precinct is at a school and I want them to know now that they need to avoid those times if they are concerned about having to walk too far or being able to park close to the entrance, and avoid either those times or to vote early or vote by mail.
Linda Robbins, that's all the time we have. Thank you for joining us here on Interchange.
Thank you.
Coming up after a short break, we'll talk on the phone with Republican U.S. Senate candidate Richard Murdoch. Stay with us. And hello, good evening. Welcome to Interchange. I'm your host, Ryan Dawes. On the phone with me is Richard Murdoch, who is running for the Republican primary against Senator Richard Lugar, seeking the senator's office. Richard Murdoch was elected the Indiana State Treasurer in November in 2006, as well as in 2010. Thank you very much for joining us here on Interchange, Richard.
Thank you, Ryan. Great to be with you.
Now, first off, what I want to know from you is, let's start from the beginning. Where are you from, and where do you live now?
Well, I'm not a native Hoosier. I actually grew up in northwestern Ohio and came to Indiana in 1973 to go to graduate school, and found the state so fascinating, I have been here ever since. I live in the what we like to call here in southwestern Indiana, dynamic Darmstadt, which many of your listeners have probably never heard of Darmstadt. But it's just north of Evansville, so we're off in the far southwestern corner of Indiana.
Now, I touched on a little bit of your professional and educational history. Talk a little bit about the professional experience and political experience you have, and as it is specifically relevant to running for in the U.S. Senate.
Sure thing. And I am the first to admit, if you laid out a path to get to the United States Senate, you would probably choose just about any course other than the one that my life experiences have been. I have as an undergraduate degree in the combined fields of biology, geology, and chemistry, as you mentioned, a graduate degree in geology. Worked in the energy business here in Indiana for over 30 years, expanded, got into the construction and environmental businesses as well. But I'd always had a great interest in American history. And back almost 35 years ago, I gave myself the goal every night to read 10 pages of American history. And while I can't say I've done it every night, I certainly have 90% of the time. And I've just, through that process, came more and more involved with government and governing, got involved with politics back in the late 1980s, and have just ever since been kind of moving in that direction career-wise. I had the wonderful occasion on March 5th, 2001, to write in my daytimer. It was close to my 50th birthday, and I wrote, "Today I begin the second half of my working career." I had had the good experiences of being involved in businesses that I'd owned part of. I'd sold those, and I decided I was going to use the second half of my career in public service. And through that path, we've gone into statewide politics, as you mentioned, been elected twice as state treasurer during some tumultuous times. And a few years ago now, I was asked by members of the Republican Party to consider running for the United States Senate. And thus, here we are 2 years later and 38 days ahead of a primary and looking very good at our chances.
Now, I want to know a little bit about your campaign for treasurer. And what did you learn as state treasurer? You took on the Obama administration over the their dealings with the auto industry. Talk a little bit about what you learned about labor issues, about what you learned about the economy and the role that the auto industry plays in this,
sure.
As well as obviously this would have a huge learning process with the legal system. What did you learn and gain from that, and ultimately where do you stand on it now?
Well, it was certainly an interesting time. I mentioned a few moments ago when I was serving as state treasurer, it's been tumultuous. If anyone had told me back in 2005 when one of the governor's aides called and asked if I would run for state treasurer, if someone could have looked in their crystal ball and said, "Oh, by the way, Richard, and while you are state treasurer, you will be there for the biggest financial collapse in history. You will be involved in a case that will go to the United States Supreme Court twice. And because of that, be called to testify to two committees of the United States Congress." And I would urge your listeners not to put that last one on their bucket list. That is not a fun experience. But if anyone had told me those things, I might not have ever sought the office of state treasurer. But by chance, by happenstance perhaps, I was there for the big financial meltdown. Part of that financial meltdown included the collapse and ultimate bankruptcy of Chrysler Corporation. Three funds of Indiana government, the Major Moves Construction Fund, the Indiana State Police Pension Fund, and the Teachers Retirement Funds of Indiana, had purchased secured debt in Chrysler. And to make a long story very short, if you have secured debt, it simply means in the event of a bankruptcy, you get your money back first. It doesn't guarantee you a single penny, but before any non-secured creditor would receive the first penny, every secured creditor would be paid back 100 cents on the dollar. That's been the law forever until the Chrysler bankruptcy. The Obama administration, in fact, many of the errors and what I maintain were gross illegalities actually started during the George W. Bush administration, during the Bush presidency, and they were continued on through the Obama presidency. Money that was allocated to bail out the banks was ultimately thrown at the car companies. The fact that we were secured creditors didn't matter at all. Non-secured creditors were picked from down in the bottom of the pile and put at the top, and we were knocked down to the bottom. This has never happened in American history. And our teachers and our retired police officers who had worked and sweat and toiled and put their money, this is not some government fund, this was their personal money in their pension plans, had that money ripped away when the law was thrown away. When I was elected, I took an oath of office that said I would support the laws of the state of Indiana and support and uphold the Constitution of the United States. I saw those laws being violated. I'd also taken on the responsibility as trustee of the state police pension fund to be a fiduciary, which means you put other people's interest in front of your own to protect their wealth and interest. Because of what was happening, even though it was said to be a very risky, dangerous political type move, we took on the Obama administration, went to the U.S. Supreme Court. We lost in the first round, and ultimately, on our appeal, the U.S. Supreme Court struck down the underlying decision that allowed the Chrysler case to happen. But unfortunately, our pensioners never got their money back. It wasn't so much, to your question, a learning process about the law or about the world of finance. In some ways, it was a testing process of myself, because the pressure in that 6-week period was unbelievable. Because we have 6,000 Chrysler employees in Indiana, and I was hearing from every one of them because they thought somehow I was going to cost them their job. But my sworn duty was to protect the people for whom I was a fiduciary. We took on the task, and we did it.
Now, what I want to know is, what is your overall opinion of what we now refer to as the bailout of banks and the bailout of the auto industry?
Well, the bailouts of the auto industry very much remain to be seen, their success. It's how do you measure success these days? You know, if you measure success as some people still are working, some people got to keep their assets while other people lost theirs, if that's success, well, then I guess it's success. But the bigger question is it government's role in both the banks and the auto companies? Is it the government's role to pick winners and losers? I argue that it is not. You know, one of the differences between myself and Mr. Lugar is he voted to bail out the banks. He voted to bail out the car companies. I wouldn't have cast those votes in that way. You know, this new Dodd-Frank bill, which is a mammoth reform of the financial industry, I'm the first to admit there certainly needed to be some rework there. But what we've done now is literally promulgated into law the theory that some businesses are too big to fail. Prior to 2009, that was kind of a going construct, but it wasn't really law. Now it is. And we're going to have a few very big banks that now have a safety net underneath them by law. And I always ask folks the question, if you know there's a safety net underneath you and you're a banker, are you inclined to take more risk or fewer risk in the future? And the answer is, of course, more risk. So we've seen the bailouts. We've seen them, I think, as Band-Aids for the short term. But in the long term, there's a lot of questions remaining as to whether or not they're going to be effective. Certainly in the auto industry, there's a lot of questions continuing with GM and Chrysler and the fact that the U.S. taxpayers have been hit for at least $23 billion in losses so far. Yeah, people have got their jobs, but was it the right thing? I still argue it was not.
So it's more of a procedural discrepancy you have. Now, with banking, we have you object to the government supporting these banks when the banks themselves made decisions that put them in the mess that, in the first place. Now, what is the solution to that, in your opinion, if we're not going to intervene basically post recession or post failure? What sort of Is there regulations that you want in place that will prevent this sort of thing so as to protect pensions that you mentioned earlier?
Well, they're certainly separate issues as far as the pensions. They can be interrelated, but to the banking industry specifically, certainly we need regulations of banking. I think some of the things that happened in the past, the so-called Glass-Steagall Act, I think is something that we might well consider repealing, in the sense that it was allowing the banking industry to get in multiple types of banking, and there was kind of cross-pledging of assets, and that's in part what led to the difficulty that we went through. You know, what we see, though, with the new Dodd-Frank bill is something that, as state treasurer, I'll tell you, I'm particularly concerned about, because here in Indiana, one of my duties as state treasurer is to oversee, as the secretary investments manager, something called the Board for Depositories. We work with all the local banks of Indiana that have local public money, which is to say, if the city of Bloomington wants to put money in a bank, that bank has to be certified by the Board for Depositories. A few months ago, we had 197 banks in Indiana. Now we're down to, I believe, 179. There is a consolidation that is happening because of Dodd-Frank, because of the excessive regulations, because of the requirements that they've put in place that are causing smaller banks that have been very safe banks. They haven't posed great risk to their investors and certainly to their depositors, but now they are losing any margin they have to be economically viable, and so those banks are merging and disappearing, and I think that's a bad thing for Indiana communities. So I certainly think a lot of what Dodd-Frank brought into place is bad for the community banks of Indiana, and certainly there are aspects of that I'd like to see repealed.
Now, I really appreciate you getting into specific legislation that's currently up for consideration, and I want to continue that. What are some other issues that Hoosiers can expect you to support and or vote against, any imminent legislation that you see, if elected, that you will be faced to make a decision on?
Sure. Let me go two areas, if I may. One, as far as when I arrive in the United States Senate, assuming that happens in the 1st of January of 2013, as of this day, today, we don't know what the status of Obamacare will be through the actions of the Supreme Court. But let's assume for a moment it is still viable when I get there. I certainly am one who would vote to repeal Obamacare. However, I am not one of those Republicans who says, let's repeal, 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 without having an alternative that we should move forward. I happen to like something called the option program that has been presented by Representative Paul Brown from Georgia, who happens to be a medical doctor as well. I think his plan, and it basically consists of several parts, including allowing health insurance companies to sell products across state borders, just like automobile insurance companies do. It would encourage people to start up healthcare savings accounts, and it would do something that should have been done years ago, which is for every individual, they ought to be able to deduct from their taxes their healthcare costs. You know, businesses that are paying for health insurance for their employees get to deduct it, but individuals don't. Part of that plan also, and I've spent time with dozens of doctors over the last year around Indiana who are so frustrated with the amount of government regulations that they have to deal with, and by that I mean literally doing the paperwork on an hour-by-hour basis. Dr. Brown's plan would greatly reduce that paperwork load, and I think that would be a good thing. You know, all those steps of starting to make doctors, number one, more productive in the workplace, and by also allowing them to be more competitive, you're going to bring costs down. When you start to bring costs down, more individuals, even low-income individuals, may see health insurance as something that they can afford, and I think that's a much better path. Clearly, I do not believe the United States government has, nor should it have, the ability to order its citizens to buy health insurance products, because, as has been said many times in the last several weeks, if the government can order you to buy that, what can they not order you to do? I think it's clearly the wrong move.
That's interesting. Now, you're clearly in favor of making health insurance more approachable, but of course not mandated. What do you think about a single-payer system in which maybe the government chose, or the government provided health insurance? And of course, there's all kinds of moderations of that where it's just a single-payer system, and that's the only option you have if you want insurance, or you could couple that with private offering of insurance so that maybe that would require the private institutions to become more competitive. What do you think about health insurance options, and you know, how could it improve?
The single payer system that we are very quickly moving towards is the problem. You know, there are only two areas of life where higher technology results in higher cost. Think about that for a minute. In every area of American life where you have technology coming on, ever increasing the productivity of products, it always leads to lower costs. You know, when cell phones first came out, they cost hundreds of dollars. Now you can buy a cell phone for less than $20. Smartphones, when they first came out, were $1,000. Now they're routinely down to $200. There's only two areas where that rule doesn't apply: the United States Defense Department and the healthcare industry. Why? Because both of them have essentially a single customer, and that is the United States government. There's no competition. There's nobody at the government side who's routinely looking to bring costs down. You know, one of the things of Dr. Brown's plan that I do like very much is because it would also help create health insurance pools so that people could buy more catastrophic coverage. It would also allow for something called premium support, which was originally presented by Congressman Paul Ryan as part of his budget plan, so that seniors could basically be setting money aside and have some payment down the road that if they don't spend, they get to keep. In other words, they get the responsibility of watching over those dollars and demanding lower cost. If we go to a single-payer system, two things will result. Cost will continue to go up, and the quality of service will continue to go down. I've already spoken to doctors in Indiana, and I could mention several by name, who have told me they're done. They're tired of dealing with the government. They're just getting out of medicine. And these are young people who haven't been out of medical school 10 years. They recognize that they are not being allowed to do what they went to school, what they came to love doing, which was practicing the science of medicine. As one of them said to me not long ago, I'm no longer a doctor. I'm really a bookkeeper in a white coat. And that's shocking. It's really disappointing. There's something... and I believe the letters are ICB codes. Under the healthcare system currently, if a physician is treating someone under Medicaid or Medicare, they have to treat every symptom, every process, every procedure according to a code, and there are 144,000 possible codes. If you have a broken wrist, as many as 1,500 of those codes could apply. Now, that sounds kind of inane, but here's where it's important. If at the end of the year the doctor is audited and it's found that he's made, say, 8% errors in assigning the codes, he has to pay back 8% of the money that he has received from government. It doesn't matter whether the patient was healed or not. It's all based on the coding. Doctors who want to do science, who want to do medicine, are fed up with that kind of stuff. And it's not making our healthcare system better. It's just government gone wild at the healthcare level.
Now, would this red tape, as you describe, with the number of ICB codes that a doctor has to worry about while they're treating a patient, would these be reduced under Dr. Brown's plan?
Oh, absolutely. They wouldn't be there at all. I mean, because, again, the instead of doing medicine ostensibly for the U.S. government, those doctors are providing medicine to the patients. You know, there's something else about Obamacare that is so expansive that I don't hear, and I'm going to use the word libertarian, you know, the small L, not in the party, but I have some pretty libertarian tendencies. And one of the things that scares me to death, and again, scares physicians, is this massive electronic data system. You know, the fact that it's wonderful. I hope every hospital in America goes to electronic data, paperless hospitals. That's fine. But when they all get tied together, as they are destined to do and designed to do under this national network, the act of putting all of your very private, very personal information into a computer government database, I think should frighten us all. Especially, let's go back to those codes. If we get to the point, as most physicians think we would very quickly, where healthcare is going to be rationed, Well, the people in D.C., that 15-member non-elected board of something called the Independent Payment Advisory Board, IPAB, could look in and say, well, we're not going to treat people with this code anymore. And they know who you are because they have one big government database. And all of a sudden, everybody with that code gets effectively taken off the system. It is a frightening Big Brother type of environment that I don't think Americans would really feel comfortable in. Most are not aware of, but they need to learn about. And again, that's a bad sign for the recovery of our economy. If we could, let's go that way for just a moment, because you know we have the $15.3 trillion debt increasing at $4 billion a day. There is a threat to our economy. I don't think the people who are in D.C. today, in control of D.C., are ever going to see and have the wisdom to turn that around because they're not willing to make the hard choices.
Now, I'm glad you mentioned that. What are some of those hard choices?
The hard choice, first of all, is to face this reality. We cannot raise taxes enough to pay off our debt. This year, as I mentioned a moment ago, $4 billion a day we spend more than we take in. We hear about taxing the rich. If the government today had a tax policy that every American who made over $100,000 a year was taxed at 100% for everything over $100,000, the government just came in and seized it. So no one made more than $100,000. The government took everything else.
But nobody's really
proposing that,
though, right?
If the government did that today, that means starting on January 1st, our budget would be balanced until about just about this time, about the end of March. And then starting the 1st of April, once again, we're $4 billion a day in the hole. That's how serious our problem is just on a year-to-year basis. And, of course, what we have is a deficit each year keeps being added up to be what our national debt is. So we can't tax our way out of the problem. Frankly, the political will is not there to dramatically roll back the size of government the way it needs to be. And so there's only one other choice, and that is we have to grow our way out of this problem. We have to be growing the economy at least at 3.5% increase of our GDP every year. And if we do that and sustain it, then we can eventually grow out. But we do need to be rolling back the size of government. The best thing we could do today to begin to help grow the GDP is to help this be a better, more friendly business environment. And that takes us to the regulatory environment and the tax environment on businesses. And we need to roll back those taxes as well as dramatically roll back the regulatory environment.
Now, what's some spending that could be rolled back?
I'm sorry, what is what?
What is some examples of spending that could be rolled back, in your opinion?
Sure. Well, let's talk about what we can't change. We can't change the levels of interest on our debt as much as we'd like to. Today, the Federal Reserve has got some very artificial policies in place that are continuing to crush the level of interest rates so that we're paying about 1% on U.S. government debt, a historically low level. And by the way, if the Fed loses control of that situation and our debt rates expand greatly, we will be paying instead of in daily charges just in interest on our debt, we'll be paying $3 to $4 billion a day just to pay our debt. So, again, just to make people aware of the size of the problem. Where we have to roll back the spending, though, I mean, we have to, I think, as Paul Ryan said, start with Medicare and Social Security, and we have to say this first. If you're over the age of 55 today, the government has made a fundamental promise with you. They've delivered a social contract that cannot be violated. I absolutely, totally agree with that. But we have to start, and by that I mean what you've been promised, you're going to get through the rest of your lifetime. But we need to start immediately in telling the people between the age of 50 and 55 there's a different set of promises for them, and 40 and 45 and 35 and 40 and so on. I think it's absolutely immoral for any person or any government to make promises that it knows it cannot fulfill. And today, if people are 27, 28 years old, if they think they're going to get the benefits that people who are retiring today are going to receive, it's just not going to happen, and it'd be immoral to give them a promise we can't keep. We need to start changing the set of expectations. On the so-called non-discretionary part of government, I've put forward my own plan to help roll back the cost, And I start by eliminating the Department of Commerce, the Department of Housing, Urban Development, the Department of Education, and the Department of Energy. I also think we need to flatline the budget over the next 10 years, let a lot of government attrition as far as government employees take place, and start to roll back the cost. My 10-year plan would call for government to be reduced $7.6 trillion, and that's no question a big number. The amazing thing, though, last November, when the so-called supercommittee arguments were going on, what the Congress could not commit to doing was to reduce $1.2 trillion over 10 years, and that $1.2 trillion equates to less than 3% of total government spending, 3%, and they couldn't find a way to even cut it. Most Hoosier families can cut 3% in a year, let alone 10 years. In fact, most of them have done it over the last few years.
Now, if the government could not or would not cut 3%, yet you're calling for a much higher amount, if elected, you know, how will you go about making the government, the federal government, smaller in the way you see fit, given that there is a history of resistance?
Yeah, that's a great question, Ryan. And I will guarantee you, between now and next fall, you're going to see little grainy TV commercials, negative ads, of me with a quote that I use all the time. Because I get asked, you know, what about bipartisanship? Here's my quote. Bipartisanship has taken us to the very brink of bankruptcy. We do not need bipartisanship. We need the application of principle. Bipartisanship is Democrats saying, let's spend $500 billion we don't have, and Republicans saying, no, that's horrible. Well, let's spend $300 billion we don't have, and in the end, they end up spending $400 billion we don't have. That's not sustainable. We need, and by the way, let me point something out. During the arguments when Obamacare was being passed, I don't recall any hue and cry for bipartisanship. You know, there was not a single Republican in the House or the Senate who voted for Obamacare. I don't remember any cry for, let's have bipartisanship. What has to happen to turn this country around in the direction that I would like to see it go and the way I've laid out here in this discussion, there has to be a conservative majority. And notice I did not say Republican, because I think there may be some very patriotic, very sound-minded Democrats who are going to start to join on to this theme as well. There has to be enough conservative-minded people in Congress who recognize the threat we face when we're talking about having debt payments of several billion dollars per day. We have to have conservatives there who are willing to say, we live within our means. It isn't going to be something we can continue to argue about. I will tell you, as state treasurer, I go to a lot of meetings of finance, and the current joke in the world of finance is, what's the difference between Greece and the United States of America? And the answer is, about 8 months. Now, that's not very funny. It causes a chuckle among people in the financial world. But they know Greece has tried to borrow its way to prosperity, and it hasn't worked. They know you cannot borrow, spend, print your way back to prosperity. It just can't be done. And we've got to get this under control, and it's going to take real discipline.
We're speaking with Richard Murdoch, elected Indiana treasurer in 2006. He's now running against Senator Dick Lugar in the Republican May primary for U.S. Senate. Stay with us. We'll be right back after a short break. And we're back. We're speaking with U.S. Senate candidate Richard Murdoch on the phone. Richard, we've been speaking a lot about healthcare, general spending of the federal government. What are some other ways in which you think you can distinguish yourself from not only Senator Lugar, but the Democrats, one of which you'll be running against in November if it turns out you win in May?
Sure. Well, with the Republican primary coming up on May 8th, and I would urge your Republican voters who might be listening to check us out at richardmurdoch.com. There are a lot of things listed on the website where he and I clearly differentiate ourselves, but you know, I am certainly more conservative than Mr. Lugar. I always say, and I mean it from the bottom of my heart, Dick Lugar is a nice man. He is a person for whom I have great respect. He's a person for whom I've voted many times. But I do believe the 30 years, 36 years now that he spent in the United States Senate sharply contrast with the 31 years I've had in the private sector. You know, my willingness to take on issues of finance, I think, is quite different than what his has been. I don't think many Hoosiers can, off the top of their head, recall a time when Dick Lugar was out there aggressively talking about what we need to do to get our budget in balance. Senator Lugar has spent a lot of time, has a lot of expertise in foreign affairs, and I salute him for that. But the fact is, most Hoosiers right now are more concerned about what's going to happen to their farm, to their property, to their own life. And while we cannot, and I would never suggest, we withdraw from foreign policy discussions, the United States of America has to lead the world, or the world will be a darker place. We do have to, and this is where I differ with Mr. Lugar a bit, we do have to be rebuilding our economy as our first priority so that we can maintain that position of being first as a superpower. And by superpower, I'm not talking about military, I'm talking about economically. You know, in 2014, for the first time in the life of any living American, the United States will not have the world's largest economy. I mean, let that sink in. Not during the lifetime of any American who's alive today have we not ever, always, every day of our lives, had the leading economy in the world, but it's soon to come to an end. We owe China more than $3 trillion, and we're continuing to borrow money from them every day, and the worrisome sign is they're not wanting to lend it as much as they used to. That's troubling. You know, other areas where Mr. Lugar and I disagree, certainly he's been very quick to support some of the Obama Supreme Court and liberal justices. I wouldn't have voted for Sonia Sotomayor. I would not have voted for Elena Kagan. A lot of issues out there. I mentioned he voted for the bailouts. I wouldn't have done that. He's certainly been a co-sponsor of something called the DREAM Act, which I wholeheartedly disagree with, because once again, it's government picking winners and losers, taking the children of a certain group of illegal immigrants and giving them special rights. And I think that's wrong. I think when you incentivize people by rewarding bad behavior, you're going to get more of it. So that doesn't make good sense to me.
Now, one of the things that the race between you and Senator Lugar has brought into the media is a question of residency and whether or not, you know, what kind of roots a representative has in the geographic area where they represent. And so what I want to know from you is, you've stated quite clearly that you feel that he should have more of a presence and should have over the past had a more of a presence, a physical presence, a residence in the state in which he's representing. But I think the bigger issue here is representation and how approachable you are. I mean, we do live in a digital age. And so regardless of what Lugar has done in the past, what can you do in the future as a representative, if elected, to make yourself more approachable to your citizens and so that you still have your I mean, obviously you're going to be spending an immense amount of time in Washington, as you're already familiar with. But how do you plan on keeping in touch with those that you represent, those that voted against you as well as those that voted for you? What channels of communication can you commit to having?
Well, that's a great question, and you framed it exactly right, and I salute you, because a lot of people that interview me have missed the point. The residency questions that Mr. Lugar faces are about whether or not he gets to vote from a certain address and whether or not he actually lives there. And clearly now he's made a deal with the Election Commission in Indianapolis and Marion County to say he doesn't have to live at the place from which he will be voting. Now, the problem I have with that, and I've talked about all along, and to use your word, and you used it exactly correct, it's the physical presence. And it's not my demand. It is the Constitution of the United States, Article 1, Section 3, not Indiana law, that says what the qualifications are to be a United States senator. There are only three. Number one, you must be over the age of 30. Senator Lugar and I both clearly passed that test. Number two, you have to have been a citizen of the United States for 9 years. We're both clearly meeting that test. And number three, and these are critical words, it says, and I quote, when elected, must be an inhabitant of that state. Not me. Article 1, Section 3, U.S. Constitution saying that. So I think there's a real question whether or not the constitutional standard is met here. To your point as to how do you really maintain that standard, you live in Indiana. It's as simple as that. I believe in representative government, and I think that's what our founding fathers meant. They expected people to be representatives by living, actually inhabiting, having a physical presence in the state. When I'm a United States Senator, I will do exactly what almost all the Indiana congressmen do, which is come home every weekend. I have a home in Evansville. I have a condo in Indianapolis that I live in during the week, and I intend to keep that even when I'm U.S. Senator, because there's so much business that takes place out of central Indiana. You know, I believe in town hall meetings. When I was a county commissioner for 8 years, we effectively had one every Monday night. It's a great way to govern because people come right up to you. They know who you are. They want to lay their problems before you. You know, I can't recall the last time Dick Lugar had a town hall meeting. You know, and by the way, it's not unusual for senators to go home on the weekends. Just last week, I was with Senator Mike Lee from Utah. He goes home every weekend to Utah. And yet, Mr. Lugar has decided he doesn't want to live here, apparently because it's too inconvenient. It takes an hour and 22 minutes from Reagan to Indianapolis International. I don't understand it. I don't think that's inconvenient at all. So I think, to your point, how do you be representative? How do you make yourself available? By physically having that presence, by pledging to come back every weekend to travel the state. I look forward to that. I love this state. I said at the outset of this interview, you know, I came here by choice, and I've stayed by choice. I love this state, and there's no place better on earth than Indiana.
Now, Bloomington in particular, I don't know if you know a whole lot about our local government meeting structure, but it has a very strong public comment component to it. It's almost a part of the local government's culture here. And so you did mention the town hall meetings, and I think that would be very interesting to especially a lot of Bloomington listeners. What are some other ways, you know, in which you mentioned town hall meetings? What are some other ways in which you can interact with citizens? I mean, don't get me wrong, we respect the office of the U.S. Senate, but if you're representing us, it feels like citizens will want to have a more direct line of communication with you. What are some ways in which we can be guaranteed that?
Well, certainly in this wonderful electronic age, there are whole staffs within the Senate offices of every one of the 100 senators who are there today that are dealing with constituent issues. Here in Indiana, there will be at least three offices and probably more than that around the state, as there are today, working for both Senator Coates and for Senator Lugar. I mean, there is that personal side. But if I understand the full gist of your question about me personally, it is about me personally traveling the state and being available. I was sharing with someone just last night. They made the comment they see a great similarity between myself and Governor Daniels, in that we seem to be two politicians who actually truly enjoy eating a good pork tenderloin sandwich, meaning at the local cafe, at the county fair, at the local festival. And they're right. The governor enjoys doing that. I enjoy doing that. It's just governing is about listening more than anything else. You know, I've done a lot of speaking during this interview, but frankly, I really enjoy those town hall meetings, and they're tough to run sometimes because people come at you upset. But you got to have the personal presence there, and I look forward to providing that. It's certainly a pledge I'll make here and make anywhere that when I'm a U.S. Senator, I'll do it because I want to hear what people have to say. I commented about talking to the many doctors around the state. I've talked literally to hundreds of businessmen to get a sense of what it's going to take to get the economy going. I talk to bankers every week. I mean, the economy is so complex that we've got to have every voice being heard. And today, I think there are too few in Washington, either in the House or the Senate, who take the time to allow that to happen.
Well, Richard, I know we are burning daylight, and I know that you wanted to get out and mow the yard before the day is done. But I just really thank you for talking with us here on Interchange.
Well, my great pleasure, and it's a rare thing when I'm home and get to mow my own lawn, so I'm looking forward to it tonight. Thank you.
Real people.
Real issues.
This is your forum.
This is Interchange.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers working in the studios of Community Radio WFHB in Bloomington, Indiana.
Interchange fosters unfiltered open dialogue on the people, issues, and events impacting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Comments, suggestions, and program ideas may be sent directly to the Interchange staff.
The email address is news@wfhb.org.
That address once again is news@wfhb.org.